This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Oh, it was such a bummer.
It's a little bit like watching Jeb Bush, you know, on the campaign trail. A little rusty, you know?
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, for the first podcast of 2016, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Han Solo of education policy, Robert Pendicio.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah? Are you sure? Have you seen the new movie?
No, I haven't.
Okay, then maybe you wouldn't.
How can he be in it? He's 60-some-odd years old now.
Robert, do you pay attention to any pop culture?
I used to.
The original cast is back. I saw the movie with my family.
So it's called Star Walkers?
It's a great movie. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Even took the
Star Wars
6-year-old. He was 5 at the time, and he did well. We had to talk him through a couple of the scary scenes, but I think that PG-13 rating was probably overblown. No spoiler alerts here for people that haven't seen it, but you got to see it, Robert.
I'm just not going to.
You're Mr. Cultural Literacy, right?
I am, but I'm also Mr. Anti-Hype.
All right, but on the cultural literacy front, right?
Sure.
Let's be honest. It's not just that people have to understand historical references. They also have to understand some pop culture references.
Did I say
this is
who? When you call me Han Solo, I know who the character is. I got the reference.
All right, good. And that he's played by Harrison Ford.
Disney needs 17 more of my dollars?
Wait a minute. It's well worth it.
Speaking of cultural literacy, did you see this thing where they're closing Frontierland in Disneyland to make room for...
Star Wars Awakens.
Star Wars. So goodbye, Davy Crockett.
And by
goodbye,
the way,
Swiss Family Robinson. Goodbye.
Well, that's too bad. Look, there's another education tie-in, of course, is that all of this money, you know, really went to George Lucas. I mean, you know, Star Wars bought the rights for, what, $2
billion? $4 billion, but who's counting?
$4 billion,
I believe it was $4
billion. And he put a lot of that money into Edutopia, which we need to talk to those
really,
folks
really
about.
Signing me up.
Hey, I'm just saying that maybe they need to get on board with, you know, content-rich curriculum.
It's not going to happen.
Well, we could try. Okay, hey, lots to talk about. I should say, by the way, we have this hope as we enter, can you believe it, our 10th year of podcasting here.
Goodness.
At the Education Gadfly Show, of doing something of an overhaul of the podcast. So we're going to freshen it up for the first time in 10 years.
I'm fired?
Well, for the first time since Rick Hess was my co-host, and then he didn't get fired. He quit.
Okay.
Right. No, you're not getting fired, but we're going to try to change the format a little bit. Just give listeners a warning. That may be a few weeks still away, but I'm kind of excited about it. One thing we won't change, Amber's Research Minute, because people would hurt me if I did that.
As long as I don't have to know what I'm talking about, then okay.
But for at least a few more weeks, we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. So, Clara, let's get started.
All right. Robert, you recently wrote about what you called the miseducation of Trump voters. Has the education reform movement failed them? How?
I'm not sure the education reform movement has failed white working class Trump voters. I think it simply ignored them. And I had this epiphany where I realized, my dad was a conservative guy. He was, but more to the point, he was a blue collar guy. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a high school education. Worked for American Airlines from the day he got out of the army until the day he died. And I had this epiphany where I realized if he were my age now, he'd be a Trump voter.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is because the kind of life that he had that I benefited from, where he was a blue-collar guy but decidedly upwardly mobile, not because he had educational credentials, because he got a job and he worked hard.
Mm-hmm.
That world is gone away largely. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that my dad would have had that kind of career today. And I think that kind of economic dislocation breeds resentment. And those of us in ed reform, when we have this discussion, mm-hmm. who do we talk about? Not guys like my dad. We talk about low-income black and brown kids in the inner city.
No, I think it's a really good point. I mean, look, if you go way back to the 80s and you look at some of the very first education reform governors, and you mm-hmm. go back to the Bill Clintons and the Lamar Alexanders and the Dick Rileys, and you know, they were warning that this was coming, right? They were talking about this. They were seeing that their economies were changing. They knew that their factories, in some of those places were closing down, or if they were going to get factories, which they did in some respects successfully in the South, at least, that it was going to be higher skilled jobs.
Right.
And they knew that education was going to be the key, right? And they preached that, and they pushed for education reform as a result. And frankly, you'd think if we had been more successful, more aggressive, had actually done a better job of helping more kids get real skills,
mm-hmm.
by the way, not just traditional college prep skills, but also career and technical education skills, you wonder if white working class population would be doing as poorly as it is. Look, not only is this a political phenomenon, you know, there's a recent study showing that that white working class people are dying earlier before.
That's right. That's exactly right. The only demographic to whom that's happening.
That's right. I mean, this is almost unheard of. The only other place you can see this is in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, there is something really going wrong with people that only have a high school education, that they are struggling big time. And I do think it's fair to say that we failed them, or our, you know, previous generations of reformers, that we didn't get the job done in time to help them.
Yep.
Now the question is, are we going to get the job done in time to help their children?
Yeah, I think that's a fair
question.
That's
got to be a big part of our mission.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, this is not a political statement, but I think there is some value coming out of the Trump campaign from this. It's forcing guys like you and me to say, hey, wait a minute. There's this enormous boxcar numbers of Americans that we have simply not been thinking about to the degree to which we need to.
Very well said, Robert. Okay, topic number two.
Mike, you took a bold stance on sex education this week. Why should schools be teaching the IUD?
We are not shying away from controversy at the beginning of 2016.
We are not. But look, I think every kid should have an IEP. Individualized education is exactly what every kid...
I said IUD.
Wait, what's that?
Otherwise known as the intrauterine device.
Oh, no,
there,
you didn't.
I used the U word. I did. I had to say it. So, first of all, I should acknowledge that this is an article a lot of people don't want to have written by a man or a middle-class man or a middle-aged man or... and many of the other boxes.
And that's why I didn't write it.
Into, yes. But I did. I acknowledge that some of my staff wasn't crazy about me doing so. Look, there's new data out from the Centers for Disease Control where they surveyed high school health teachers and asked them about a whole bunch of things, but including what they taught in sex ed. And I just found it fascinating and disturbing. And, you know, not surprisingly, in a lot of the states, the more conservative red states, there doesn't appear to be a lot of sex ed going on. I look particularly at whether they teach the IUD, because there is this evidence and research that's been coming out about how this type of birth control, along with other long-acting reversible contraceptives that are dramatically more effective in preventing pregnancies, and that if you care about things like upward mobility and opportunity, and not just upper mobility, you care about this for middle-class kids, upper middle-class kids too, if you care about student success, you care about young people delaying parenthood until they finish their education and get a foothold in the economy, you know, in the labor market. And yet we still have, you know, thousands, if not millions of young people getting pregnant as teenagers or in their very early 20s. And there's tons of evidence that is bad for them. It's bad for the babies. It's bad for society. And, you know, if we could get young people using more effective birth control, we could dramatically change that picture. And so, look, I'm still obviously an education reform guy, but if there's one other, you know, big issue that I would tackle, it's this one. And there's a connection. The connection is, you know, most schools do teach some kind of sex ed. Just show kids this information. Just make sure they understand, you know, that if they are relying only on other kinds of birth control, they are likely to make a mistake at some point and get pregnant or get their girlfriend pregnant. And that's going to have huge consequences for their lives.
Here's what fascinates me about this discussion without taking a stance on what you've written. It always fascinates me the degree, and I say this as a teacher. I see this in the school in which I work. It amazes me the things that we valorize and the things that we are reluctant to valorize. If you think about it, constantly during the school day, we are sending signals to kids about things that we value and things that we do not. We see this in No Excuses schools. They are awash in college banners, in the non-cognitive skills, the work habits. We are valorizing certain kinds of behaviors all the time. So it's not as if we're reluctant to tell kids what to do or what to think. And in elementary school, brush your teeth, eat three square meals. Mm-hmm. We are constantly telling kids how to live their life. But for some reason, we get squeamish when it comes to, as you just said, the success sequence. So I'm not taking a stance on this, but it's a question for me. If you know that there's something that you can preach to kids that will give them a 95% chance of escaping poverty, are you not obligated to do that?
And we understand the concerns from the right about talking about sex and you know, in some way condoning kids having sex. On the left, there's these concerns that you're somehow stigmatizing teenage
and I'm not
mothers,
taking a position on that.
That you're making, you know, creating a stigma or a shame.
Yeah. I would simply like to see every school system have this conversation. Yeah. Is this something we're going to norm in this school? Yes or no?
Right.
Involve the community, but don't ignore it.
And not just schools. I mean, the whole states are now saying things like, we're going to require everybody to take the ACT or the SAT because we want them thinking about college. Or in Louisiana now, everybody has to fill out the FAFSA, the federal aid form, again, you know, to get kids thinking about college. And yet there you are in Louisiana, a state where very little sex education is going on. And guess what? One of the major barriers to actually going to or completing college is it's early pregnancy. So, you know, look, I just hope we can have a grown up conversation about this, you know, which and it's not like it's easy. It's not like just telling kids about this is going to solve it. It's complicated. But it is the case that now most kids have access to this kind of birth control via Obamacare. Well, let's just throw more flames on the fire. You know, that the evidence is super strong that this is helpful. And it's something that I think should be part of the student success conversation.
I'm real uncomfortable with states and districts and school leaders making these decisions on behalf of children and family, but I'm absolutely in favor of them involving children and families and coming to a decision as a community. Is this something that we want to normalize? Yes or no? Don't
teach
ignore it.
The IUD. Okay, third topic.
A high-achieving school district in New Jersey has come under scrutiny for what some are calling the overwhelming pressure placed on its students. The New York Times wrote that white parents stood on one side of the debate while Asian Americans stood on the other. Is this really a clash of cultures?
What a fascinating story. Did you read this, Mark?
Oh my gosh, no, totally. Yeah. Quite interesting. And it resonates, honestly, in that, you know, I've seen some of this in Montgomery County, Maryland. You certainly see the debates in California about how many of the colleges, the elite colleges there, have a very large Asian American population. I mean, I do think that there is this angst in sort of upper middle class white America that what it would take for white kids to compete with many of the Asian American students is just simply too much. It's too much work. It's too hard. It's too much stress. And people are upset that as a result, their kids are not going to earn spots in the most elite colleges.
Interestingly, I have kind of the same take on this that I have on your IUD story, which is I actually took the time to print out the letter from this district. From the superintendent. And what rankles me here is that he's making a decision on behalf of an entire school community and usurping to a degree parents' prerogatives to say what's best for their kids. And I'm not sure that's okay.
And explain this. So the superintendent has come out and basically said,
hey, we're putting too much stress on kids.
We're going to try to take the pressure down several notches.
And a lot of parents, apparently this is strongly breaking down along Asian lines, along racial lines, that Asian parents are saying, no, we don't want the pressure taken off. We're not interested in the whole child, yada, yada, yada. We want all the APs. We want the music program. We want our kids pushed. As a parent, I don't have a problem with that. Is it what I want for my kid? Not necessarily. Yeah. But am I going to want to enforce what I want for my child upon you?
Right.
No.
And this is, of course, I mean, the story explains that a lot of Asian American families have moved to this district because I had a reputation for having, a lot of AP and challenge. And look, part of this is an issue about choice. Right. I mean, this is the challenge of school districts that have to serve all comers and, you know, try to offer something that makes everybody happy. It certainly is easier if you can find a way to allow schools to differentiate and then let parents choose among them. So, you know, another solution the superintendent could have had was say, hey, we've got some parents out there worried that it's too high octane here.
Right.
So we're going to create an alternative high school. I did my student teaching at something like this in Ann Arbor, Michigan called Community High, Commy High. I can see all my conservative friends nodding now. It all makes sense. But there's other ways to have a release valve for parents who think it's too much pressure than to say, well, we're going to go, 180 degrees in the other direction for everybody.
Well, that's exactly where the mischief happens. And actually, I'm taking this up. I'm probably going to write something about this in the next week or two because I'm earnestly curious. Are we really seeing a dramatic overstressing of kids at large? That has certainly become the media meme of the moment. I don't mean to minimize what happened in Palo Alto, but you had the teen suicides there on the cover of The Atlantic. There have been a couple of stories in the New York Times. Boy, I feel like I've seen this happen before where you see a media meme take over and suddenly it becomes what we have to do for every school. And I'm looking for evidence that we are broadly overstressing American school kids.
Right.
I'm not saying it's not there, but I haven't found it.
No, I bet it's 5% of the schools at max. But these are the schools that many upper middle class kids go to. Their parents write for The Atlantic.
And they set the tone. And what did John Dewey say? What the best and wisest parent wants for his child, so should we want for every child. Anything less is unlovely and undemocratic. So guess what? What that 5% wants is what we all get because, hey, they're the best and wisest parents, aren't they?
I think Dewey got that one wrong.
Not for my kid.
Not one of Dewey's finest moments, in my opinion.
I agree.
I mean, I understand the impulse. I understand the impulse.
Of course.
But, you know, yes, this is the challenge. This is one of the major challenges of education policy is that what upper middle class kids need and what low income kids need is arguably quite different.
And I worry that
we can't have a grown up conversation about that.
My students at a place like Democracy Prep are suddenly not going to be able to take all the APs. They're not going to get the pressure for college because, the research shows, and I'm making air quotes around the research shows that we're overstressing kids. No, you're denying them opportunity.
Mm-hmm. All righty. Well, it wraps it up for the first part of the Gadfly of 2016. Now it is time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So have you seen the new Star Wars?
I have. Of course. Had to go see it.
Well, Robert, I didn't see it yet.
Really? I thought it was pretty cool.
It was good,
really
wasn't
did.
It?
Yeah, really. Yeah. But of course, I mean, like, I'm just going to spoil it, but
Don't spoil it.
I have to, like, all right, well, why did
spoiler
he have,
alert.
Why did he have to die? I'll just say he. Why did he have to die?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe because he's like kind of too old to be a good actor at this point. I thought he was a little rusty.
That's what my mom said, too. He had to go, but oh, it was such a bummer.
It's a little bit like watching Jeb Bush, you know, on that campaign trail. A little rusty, you know, maybe he's going to get there eventually.
That's true.
And another he who, how much did he get paid for that one scene?
I just don't know.
And as my son Nico pointed out, he didn't even have a line.
No, he didn't. Well, that was your indirect spoiler alert.
Okay, right. good. Well, I'm glad to see that not everyone around here is dismissive of pop culture.
Yes.
Okay. As I have a coughing fit, Amber, tell us, what do you have this week?
All right. We have a new NBER study out that examines school vouchers and student achievement in Louisiana. This one's been getting some attention. Recall, I'm going to give you a little tidbit about the programs first for our listeners. Louisiana expanded their voucher program statewide in 2012 under good old Bobby Jindal. And by 2014, 12,000 students had applied for more than 6,000 slots to attend 126 private schools. So a lot of enthusiasm for the expansion of the project, of the program. A little bit about the program first and eligibility. I got to get through all this stuff.
This is important.
Not a minute today, people.
Look, because the debate has been, are there too many regulations on this program? Some of the private schools out. Okay, go ahead.
Yes. So the program requires that participating private schools administer the Louisiana State Test to voucher students, not the non-voucher students. Okay. The schools accept the voucher amount as the full tuition payment. It's incidentally about $3,300 less than what the students' sending districts spend per pupil. Okay. Schools with more than 40 voucher students or 10 per grade receive a rating based on the achievement of these students and can be deemed ineligible to enroll new voucher kids if they do poorly for two consecutive years. They also have to have an open enrollment policy.
That's a big deal. So no admissions if they're a school that usually has some kind of admissions requirements. That has to go out the window.
Open enrollment policy.
Okay.
Eligible students are poor, must be. On average, applicants' families earned roughly $15,000.
Oh,
golly, that's low.
That is really low.
And their schools must have gotten a mediocre or failing school accountability grade. All right, so that's the program, that's the eligibility. As for the evaluation, it focuses on roughly 1,400 grade 3 through 8 students applying for vouchers in the fall of 2012, which is the first application cohort after the program was expanded. Since the program was oversubscribed, the vouchers are randomly assigned such that some kids get them and some kids don't. All right, bottom line finding, attendance at a voucher-eligible private school reduces test scores for voucher students in math, in ELA, in science, in social studies, all four.
ELA, incidentally, was not significantly lower. Okay, it was that made the best of the four.
Mm-hmm.
Also, voucher participation specifically lowers math scores by about 0.4 standard deviation. Again, this is 1 year after the lottery. And it was about a quarter or a third of a standard deviation in the other subjects.
So these are their first year in this new school.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's important.
I mean, Mike, this is what I'm going to say later. Hello. I mean, everybody and their brother, when you have a first year outcome evaluation, everybody knows that first year evaluations of anything need to be taken with a huge grain of salt.
Okay. Yep.
All right. Anyway, another finding, voucher reduces the probability of being promoted to the next grade. And shift students into lower performance, state performance categories. They've got all these performance categories. So the outcomes, bottom line, are they're bleak. And they're even bleaker for the younger children. They go into a section of, you know, how it's worse for the younger kids. So there's no sugarcoating what went on here, okay? But, again, like I just said, it's a first-year evaluation. Everybody always says, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But it's hard to pinpoint. I know you, and you'll talk about this. You've been doing this debating in the blogosphere. It's hard to pinpoint in a quantitative study exactly what's happening, right? And some say that it's overregulation, like you said, including requiring kids to take the state test. And that was a terrible idea. And look what happened. But when you dig in, and I did this and we had some folks over email do the same, there are important findings in there. So the results show, there's like two sentences in there that show that kids that are in schools with lots of voucher kids and schools that have just few voucher kids, so you got a lot or you got a few, they're both doing poorly by these kids. So it's not likely that they're teaching to the test, which then infers changing your curriculum. Okay. So you got a lot, you got a few, you're still doing crummy. Descriptive analysis did show that these schools experience enrollment loss. It was about 13% between 2000 and 2012.
Okay.
So these participating schools were roughly 10% smaller than the non-participating schools. Okay. But again, dig in the results and you see that schools that had the fastest enrollment losses were actually not worse than other schools to which the students had applied.
And again, to some background here, some of the folks, our friends at Cato, for example, have been arguing that because of the regulations, they point to the requirement around testing, but also the admissions requirement, which I think we would agree is problematic, that some of the better private schools are sitting this out, the ones that don't need the money as much. And so they look at this whole environment, they look at the tuition, they look at everything, they've decided not to play ball. Hard to have a voucher program if the private schools don't play ball. And if the better private schools don't participate, then you might get worse performance.
Right.
But what you're saying, and they would say that, see, that the schools that are most desperate for kids and for money are the ones participating. But what you're saying is that even some of the schools that haven't shrunk that much, didn't take that many voucher kids, they're not doing well either.
Yeah. Right. So it's bad news all around for the private school sector in Louisiana. Right.
But it's in the first year. And
it's in the first year.
I mean, do we know in other of these other gold standard studies for vouchers in the first year, did we see similar findings?
Right. So, I mean, the Milwaukee study did test the test accountability provision, right? And they found that there was actually a positive bump. But that was first year, too.
But that wasn't the first year of a program. That was the
first year of the
policy.
Accountability policy. That's right. That's right.
I mean, when these things are starting, I wonder if you go way back to the Paul Peterson studies and some of these other places, Dayton and New York and D.C., you know, when you're first getting a study off the a program off the ground, when kids first transfer to new schools, we see this in charter schools, right? In the Credo data for charters, if you take out the first year, the charters look a lot better.
Yeah,
you know that we know student mobility is a challenge. Yeah. Kids lose ground in the first year, so you got to give them some time to acclimate. So we could see better results next year.
We could. I mean, the other little tidbit I wanted to add was that the fallback schools to which these kids went to were also had scores below the Louisiana average. So, you know, it's not as if that the negative results were being driven by the positive things we were seeing in these other schools. They were driven by the negative results from these private schools.
Right.
So, you know, that's important to keep in mind. And the evaluators are very, you know, blatant about that. So I think, yeah, when you I started thinking about, you know, what do we know from other voucher studies and remembering the DC one, I mean, we know that there are some positive effects to some of these voucher programs.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's mixed, right?
Well,
and you would think
but generally
mostly
quite
positive,
strong,
mostly
especially for African American kids.
Or no effect, right?
Right.
But we don't know as much about these programmatic details and structures of these programs that we need to know and really figure out which ones matter. Mm-hmm. You know, we did our study a few years ago where we looked at these regulations and, you know, and did find, as you mentioned, that the schools that chose not to participate end up saying, you know, that they want to have control over their admission policies.
And I think that that is certainly something we can agree with the Cato folks on, is how can we get more of these higher performing private schools in? What would it take? And would it take, for example, them being able to be choosy on admissions? You know, that if that's the case, that's the deal I'm willing to make. Though some people on the left would have a big problem with that.
Yeah. I mean, AEI, incidentally, because I'm one of these people that went back, because I know that AEI study that Pat Wolf did, some other folks did. When you dig into their data for Louisiana, I think it was the factoid was 34% of non-participants cited the administering the state test as a major reason why they bowed out. That's not huge, right? Yeah. And that's Louisiana-specific data.
Right. So two-thirds, it's something else.
Right, it's something else. And that's their own data. So sometimes that kind of gets lost in the conversation.
All right, lots to unpack, but interesting. And look, a gold standard study, MBER, and something that is unusual, because in these other voucher studies, we have seen these positive or neutral effects.
Yeah,
so this is one for us to scratch our heads about. All right, thanks. A great one to start off the new year.
I know, it was meaty. I hope I didn't bore people. It was
No. Of course not. We love it. We love it. All right, Amber, may the force be with you. And as my kids say, and also with you. Okay, that's all the time we've got for this week. Until next week, I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.